Chapter 13. That night, at home, as he was prancing around the house, pretending to be tripping through cornfields in slow motion, and continually exploding with sudden laughter, Arthur thought he could even bear to listen to the album of bagpipe music he had won. It was 8 o'clock, and he decided he would force himself to listen to the whole record before he phoned her. Maybe he should even leave it till tomorrow. That'd be the cool thing to do. Or next week, sometime. Nope. No games. He wanted her and didn't care who knew it. He definitely and absolutely wanted her, adored her, longed for her, wanted to do more things than there were names for with her. He actually caught himself saying things like, "Yippee!" as he pranced ridiculously round the house. Her eyes, her hair, her voice, everything. He stopped. He would put on the record of bagpipe music. Then he would call her. Would he, perhaps, call her first? No. What he would do was this. He would put on the record of bagpipe music, he would listen to it, every last banshee wail of it, then he would call her. That was the correct order. That was what he would do. He was worried about touching things in case they blew up when he did so. He picked up the record. It failed to blow up. He slipped it out of its cover, he opened the record player, he turned on the amp. They both survived. He giggled foolishly as he lowered the stylus onto the disc. He sat and listened solemnly to A Scottish Soldier. He listened to Amazing Grace. He listened to something about some glen or other. He thought about his miraculous lunchtime. They had just been on the point of leaving when they were distracted by an awful outbreak of yoo-hooing. The appallingly permed woman was waving to them across the room like some stupid bird with a broken wing. Everyone in the pub turned to them and seemed to be expecting some kind of response. They hadn't listened to the bit about how pleased and happy Angie was going to be about the £4.30 that everyone had helped to raise towards the cost of her kidney machine, had been vaguely aware that someone from the next table had won a box of cherry brandy liqueurs, and took a moment or two to cotton on to the fact that the yoo-hooing lady was trying to ask them if they had ticket number 37. Arthur discovered that he had. He glanced angrily at his watch. Fenchurch gave him a push. "Go on," she said. "Go and get it. Don't be bad-tempered. Give him a nice speech about how pleased you are, and you can give me a call and tell me how it went. I'll want to hear the record. Go on." She flicked his arm and left. The regulars thought his acceptance speech a little over-effusive. It was, after all, merely an album of bagpipe music. Arthur thought about it and listened to the music, and kept on breaking into laughter. Chapter 14. Ring, ring. Ring, ring. Ring, ring. "Hello, yes? Yes, that's right. Yes, you'll have to speak up. There's an awful lot of noise in here." "What?" "No, I only do the bar in the evenings. It's Yvonne who does lunch, and Jim, he's the landlord. No, I wasn't on." "What?" "You'll have to speak up." "What?" "No, I don't know anything about no raffle." "What?" "No, I don't know nothing about it. Hold on, I'll call Jim."
The barmaid put her hand over the receiver and called over the noisy bar.
"Here, Jim, bloke on the phone says something about he's won a raffle. He keeps on saying it's ticket 37 and he's won."
"Nah, there was a guy in the pub here won," shouted back the barman.
"He says, have we got the ticket?"
"Well, how can he think he's won if he hasn't even got a ticket?"
"Jim says, how can you think you've won if you haven't got a ticket?" "What?"
She put her hand over the receiver again.
"Jimmy keeps effing and blinding him. He says there's a number on the ticket."
"Of course there's a number on the ticket. It's a bloody raffle ticket, wasn't it?"
"He says he means it's a telephone number on the ticket."
"I'll put the phone down and serve the bloody customers, will you?"
Chapter 15. 8 hours west sat a man alone on a beach, mourning an inexplicable loss. He could only think of his loss in little packets of grief at a time, because the whole thing was too great to be borne. He watched the long, slow Pacific waves come in along the sand, and waited, and waited, for the nothing that he knew was about to happen. As the time came for it not to happen, it duly didn't happen, and so the afternoon wore itself away, and the sun dropped beneath the long line of the sea, and the day was gone. The beach was a beach we shall not name, because his private house was there, but it was a small, sandy stretch somewhere along the hundreds of miles of coastline that first runs west from Los Angeles, which is described in the new edition of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in one entry as junky, wonky, lunky, stunky, and what's that other word, and all kinds of bad stuff, woo, and in another, written only hours later, as being like several thousand square miles of American Express junk mail, but without the same sense of moral depth. Plus the air is, for some reason, yellow. The coastline runs west and then turns north up to the misty bay of San Francisco, which the guide describes as a good place to go. It's very easy to believe that everyone you meet there is also a space traveller. Starting a new religion for you is just their way of saying hi. Until you settled in and got the hang of the place, it is best to say no to three questions out of any given four that anyone may ask you, because there are some very strange things going on there, some of which an unsuspecting alien could die of. The hundreds of curling miles of cliffs and sand, palm trees, breakers and sunsets are described in the guide as boffo, a good one.